And they're all like, why would we work with you? You're in a competition. I'm like, no, guys. You're in competition with Facebook. You're in competition with all this stuff that's outside of the industry. You guys, get together. Have some fun. Protect the industry. Stop seeing me as your enemy. I'm not. I'm your partner in crime.
You're listening to Media Unscripted, presented by FIP, the podcast that chats to the big names in media about their passions, their opinions, and their personal experiences in this challenging industry.
This podcast is brought to you by PressReader, the world's largest digital newsstand. With PressReader, publishers reach diverse audiences and monetize their content in new ways. Bring your publications to every corner of the globe, including at sea and in the air. Join PressReader today.
Hello, I'm Charlotte Ricker, journalist, podcaster, and presenter of the FIP Unscripted podcast. I am very excited to introduce our second guest in this new series because Katie Vanek-Smith is a true pioneer in publishing. Now, I know that word is bandied around quite a lot, but Katie launched the UK's first ever news paywall, which I think you will agree is pretty bloody pioneering, especially as it took her nearly 10 years, yep, 10 years to persuade her bosses at the Times that people will pay for good content online. Katie then made her way to the other side of the pond to work as president of Dow Jones. And during her time there, she helped grow the Wall Street Journal subscriber base to 3 million readers, which was the largest number in its history. Katie clearly loves a challenge because she left this high-powered, high-paid, high-reward job in New York for a startup in the UK. And in 2019, she launched Tortoise Media with James Harding and Matthew Barzan. Tortoise is on a mission to slow news down. Katie said it's not about breaking news, it's about what's driving the news. And as with all things involving Katie, it's about sustaining the future of journalism. To each new venture, Katie brings an incredible energy, creativity, positivity, and tenacity, which is why she was named Pioneer of the Year at the 2016 British Media Awards. With such an impressive CV, I have to admit I was a bit intimidated about speaking to Katie, but she is great fun, which is something often lacking in the commercial side of media. She's also refreshingly open and honest, so gives a great interview. I really enjoyed speaking to her, and we hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. Katie, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Charlotte. It's lovely to meet you.
It's very lovely to meet you. I'm quite excited about this interview. There's so much I want to ask you about. I'm going to try and cram it all in. So the first thing I want to ask you about, and I've read that your motto, work hard, have fun, make history, which I love. Now, you've certainly been working hard and making history with Tortoise. And I'm wondering, though, just how much fun you've had working on a startup.
Okay, great question. I would say the last 15 months, regardless if I had been at a corporate or a startup, we haven't had as much fun as we normally have, given we've been in lockdown and COVID central. But if we put the last 15 months to one side, because obviously I did have a good run at it before we had to lock down in March of last year, am I having fun? Yes, I'm having loads of fun. I also think the other thing to say is it's a different type of fun. So working in a big organisation like News Corp for 20 plus years was super fun. It was super stressful at times, but it was also great fun. There were loads of people. There was loads of energy. It was global. It had all of the glamour of being a sort of big global media house. And you know, it was fun. Going into a startup is a different type of fun. At the end of the day, the culture of News Corp was very entrepreneurial. So actually, one of the things I was worried about was I cut out for a startup? You know, having been a corporate, in the corporate machine for 20 plus years, was I going to completely fall on my face when I went into a startup? And the answer was luckily no, because News Corp is very entrepreneurial in culture and spirit. Even though it's a big media beast. But ultimately, at the end of the day, you can find fun anywhere. Fun comes from the people that you work with. And it's where your purpose and passion aligns with the industry you're in. And I'm just really lucky. I love what I do. I might be mad because I'm not a journalist. I'm in the commercial side of journalism, which is probably not the most glamorous jobs on paper these days. But I love it. And so the fact that it's my passion, and very early on when I was in the 90s, when I started out, I realised I could be part of this industry, even though I'm not a journalist. Like, I could be part of it. And I could find sort of, my focus has been all the way through my career, how do you find a sustainable business model for the thing you love, which is journalism? Yeah. That's what makes it fun, right? So I get my fun from being with people, but also doing a job that I love and feeling that in a small, tiny way, what I do is important in the industry I work in, even though I'm not the creative gods of my industry.
Well, I was going to ask you, have you ever been tempted to have a go at creating? Do you ever read any content?
No, I don't have any creative aspirations at all. And it's funny because it's one of the reasons I don't employ commercial people in journalism, is when you're in the interview and you're finding out why they want to work in the industry. And often they'll all admit they really just want to be journalists. And I think, no, not employing you. I want people who love what they do and the job they come into. They're excited about that job in that industry. So, no, I can't write for Toffee. I sound nasal and a bit sort of grim on a podcast, so apologies to everyone listening to this. But I am creative. I do like having ideas, but I think my ideas are sort of always linked to sort of how can I make something more successful? So how can I make it make more money? How can I get more readers? How can I get more listeners? That's what I'm good at. So I think I should stick to minuting.
I mean, talking about what you're good at, now the word disruptor is kind of, it's bandied around a lot these days, isn't it? It's kind of like, it's quite a kind of a hot expression to use right now, a way of shaking up the industry. I mean, is that what you wanted to do with Tortoise? You know, were you trying to disrupt the industry that you knew so well?
So I would say Tortoise is not my disruption moment. I would say I've probably been a disruptor within the industry and the traditional industry as much as Tortoise is a continuation of the same path, if you like. And it sort of goes back to when I first started. You know how I said, like, I'm really passionate about what I do, but I found my purpose quite early on. So early on, when I was working at the Times in the 90s, I actually started in advertising sales, which I hated. And I went along to the HR lead and said, oh, I'm sorry, I think you've given the job to the wrong person. I really hate my job. And she said, oh, you're a history graduate, aren't you? And I said, yes, I am. And she said, why don't you go and spend a day in the archives? And I had the most amazing day in the Times archives. What was interesting was at the end of it, this guy, Eamon, who ran the archives for the Times and Sunday Times, said, oh, you know that the Times has never made money. And for me, that was just like a light bulb moment. It was a moment where I was like, oh, I could probably be quite good at that. I know, you know, I've run my dad's bingo. So I quite liked making money. And by the way, I don't think there's something wrong with making money. So I was quite excited by the fact that the Times has never made money. And that was sort of, I think, the thing that's driven, if you like, the 25 years that I've worked in the industry. So the disruptor question is for me, as soon as I feel like I've closed a chapter on sort of something I did. So at the Times, it was as soon as the paywall that we put in 2010 had delivered the first profits in 2013 of the Times, and it's now continued to increasingly deliver profits. That was a good moment. So in 2014, I went to the Wall Street Journal, and then at the Wall Street Journal, having been the pioneers of paid for content back in the 90s, like the FT, they had sort of stuttered a little bit. Like often happens when you've been the pioneer, you can sort of, you know, get quite, it becomes business as usual, doesn't it? So they'd stuttered, and it was like, how do we get to 3 million members? And we got to 3 million members in 2018. And so when James came along and said, oh, I'm thinking of doing this new startup, it didn't feel like I was stepping out of a traditional world into a startup to be a disruptor. It just felt like the next disruptive opportunity.
But is it what journalism needs? Is that what journalism needs now? You know, because you're saying that you're passionate about journalism, and what you want to do is you want to come up with a sustainable model for journalism. That's what you're all about, right? So is, are you thinking, okay, I've done that paywall, there's no, where else can we go? So it's you've got to keep changing, you've got to keep progressing. And so is slow news, is that your latest solution for sustainable journalism?
So I think we for the last sort of, well, for the 20th century, we had a very stable business model, right? I come out of print media, right? So
yeah,
the world I've come out of in print media, you know, there was sort of new things you could do that were exciting, that added, but you had a sort of circulation and advertising sort of business model, and you know, everything else around that was sort of added value almost. And I think and the popular press and the quality press and all, and it sustained a whole ecosystem of different types of news brands, right? And obviously there were always exceptions, like the Scott Trust here in the UK for The Guardian, which had a different model, but ultimately the business model worked regardless of what type of newspaper you were, be it a local newspaper or a national newspaper. There was enough space between advertising and cover price circulation that people could make that a successful business model regardless of media. I think the thing that's changed is there isn't one size fits all. So I think what's interesting is that, you know, when I did the paywall on the Times in 2010, people said it would fail. I mean, the competitive set were very open to criticising the fact that this was not going to be the answer. And obviously now it's considered to be the conventional and sort of faster growing way. But it doesn't work for all news brands equally. It works for the quality end of the market. But what about the populars? What are we going to do about local news? What are we going to do about The Sun and The Mirror and, you know, other titles, you know, where the model isn't as obvious? So I think the disruption that we're going through as an industry, and the reason it's such an exciting time, on one hand, or scary on the other, depending on whether you're me or someone else, I think it's exciting.
So who thinks it's scary?
Well, I think it's hard if you're in it. I think it's very hard.
You're in it.
I know, but I'm not. I don't accept the conventional wisdoms. I like to defy them. Just because it's always been that way doesn't mean it should continue to be that way. And I think that one of the things that COVID made me a bit sad about, actually, for the industry, is that people kept talking about, oh, it's just accelerated the trends. I mean, the trends have been there for 20 years, and the fact that you're sort of, oh, it's just accelerated those trends. I mean, it's sort of, for me, I find that language quite defeatist. It is that language that stops us seeing the new opportunities. We talk about them accelerating trends. Actually, from our perspective at Tortoise, we had to make as many changes as the traditional media would have had to have made to react to the COVID pandemic. And
what were the changes that you made? I mean,
well, for a start, I built a business with James that was built on the premise of being slow and open, right? Yeah. The slow piece, absolutely fine. The openness meant that you came into our newsroom physically every day and took part in our editorial conferences. So on the, you know, the 19th of March, the week before lockdown in the UK, we basically pivoted our entire in-person human open news conference to being Zoom-based think-ins.
I can imagine that even working better. Is it more inclusive? More people can come from around the world or from...
Yes. But the worry was the thing that we had built at the think-in, and you're absolutely right, those two things, big tick, much more inclusive, much easier for people to join, and also global. But the thing that we wrongly believed, actually, our own, if you like, conventional early wisdom in a startup, was that actually, to get people to share in a room, so a think-in is sort of, I always describe it as part lecture, part dinner party, part meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it has a sort of kind of listen and learn, a kind of, oh, I'm seeing people and we're networking, and then it has this sort of therapeutic element to it. And we felt that the kind of secret sauce of a think-in was in that sort of no questions, share your experiences. We want to hear your lived experience and perspective. We felt that that was the secret sauce. And would that work as well in a less intimate sort of digital virtual room?
Yeah.
Turns out luckily everyone was in the same boat. So I think the actual experiment was sort of brilliantly, there was no choice. But actually, it turns out that you can make them really human and you can make it really inclusive. And it hasn't lost any of the spirit of a thinking, which luckily we'd had a year and a bit of playing around with the thinking in real life to know the little elements that worked. But yeah, so the early opportunity, so the opportunity was not necessarily obvious, because our entire business, if you think about the global events industry, you look at them and they just stopped doing things.
Yeah.
The week before lockdown, we'd pivoted everything to digital, and then lockdown happened a week later.
Mm.
And we started to do more. We did summits, we did forums. We just sort of went, oh, look, let's have a bit more fun with this. So that was one side. The other thing that it taught us, and actually it didn't teach us, but the other thing that we did during COVID that I don't know if we would have done if it hadn't been for COVID is that, because the sort of extra, you know, we're a startup and, you know, like many people in that first month, all of our partner revenue just walked out the door, right? So we were like, ooh. So we were very sort of quick to sort of turn our commercial partners' sort of delivery into digital. But we were like, what else can we give them apart from events? Mm. And we realized that actually another sort of format was that the podcasting we were doing. And actually, if people were doing an event and had a conference, maybe we'd turn it into a podcast. And then we got to thinking. So if it, you know, a year ago, Tortoise had only really just been doing podcasts for a couple of months. We hadn't really been a sort of audio newsroom in any way.
Yeah.
And it didn't make sense, really, because our members are 55% under 45. They're more likely to listen than they are to read. And when we set up Tortoise, we'd been very much focused on building a newsroom that was designed for this first, the mobile phone first. Yeah. Actually, we were wrong about that. It's about this first. So the headphones. So actually the year of sort of lockdown and sort of working in that way meant that we also moved from being a sort of designed and delivered for the mobile first experience to designed and delivered for the headphone first experience. And that's been a massive change.
So how much of an impact, or how surprised have you been, and how much now is the podcasting playing a role in with subscribers? Is that quite a key part of the business?
Beginning to be. So what we're seeing is we're slow journalism. So we don't have the volume that a lot of the normal newsrooms have. We don't publish 500 stories a day, because we publish one story a week and then a handful of slow views on our own Tortoise timetable, as it were.
It sounds like sort of such a luxury. And God, it just sounds like heaven, just having that space. And it kind of fascinates me that it works.
Well, we're still quite hare-like in our production processes. It feels like a tortoise to the end listener, but we're still like every newsroom. We're still, here's the deadline. We always do it on deadline rather than before deadline. What's been interesting around the sort of journalism piece and the audio piece, to your point, is that because we don't have the volume of output, social media isn't really our friend. Okay. Social media isn't really a place or space that we can make an impact in or build the brand in the same way as if you're the Times or the Guardian, right? And we've done quite well, given that we're a relatively new news outfit. But it didn't ever connect properly. I mean, it was great for engagement with members, but it was never great for scale and reach. And then what we found with our audio is that actually that's delivering us amazing scale and reach. And so to your point around, does it work for the membership proposition? Absolutely, because weirdly, it's sort of almost better built for membership, because you've got the music ad-free version, the sort of listening revolution that happened in music sort of has established this idea that it's ad-free for subscribers or members. So for us, audio works brilliantly because it's for members, it's early access, like you'd get with films or anything like that, or Sky. It's early access, bonus features, it was like the DVD, and ad-free. So, and actually you're not then, you've actually got a better business in a way, because you can have your later off-platform reach distribution, so your stories can have scale and impact.
Yeah.
But actually your members get the premium experience. And so There's some interesting data coming out from our partner Acast, where you can start to see conversions between 2% and 7% from free to paid, depending on the type of podcast publisher you are. So comedy seems to work better than news, just as a headline.
Talking about what you're giving your members. Now, on another podcast, I heard you say that journalism isn't just to inform, educate and entertain. It also has a role to play in healthy democracies. And I thought it was a really interesting comment. I wanted, if you could expand on this a little bit. And also, how does this fit with the tortoise model of news?
So I think the problem we've got today is that many of the institutions that were the trusted institutions of healthy democracies are slightly out of kilter at the moment, be that the politicians or be that the press, be that the police, even in the UK in the recent weeks.
Well, in the States, yeah.
Yeah. So we're in a position where everything's sort of a little bit out of kilter from the sort of the world that sort of we grew up in, that I grew up in at least. And I do think, you know, the premise of great journalism, of holding people in power to account, of giving voice to those that might not necessarily have access to voice in those ways, and finding those stories that are hidden in plain sight, all of those things that we've said about our industry for years are so true, and even more true today than they were maybe even 50 years ago. And I think when you think about how you have to sort of be able to see yourself in things, if you just think about any of the sort of rebalancing of power that you see, whether it's the gender debate, whether it's the race and ethnic diversity debate, a lot of this is about rebalancing of power. And so what I sort of see in journalism and what I see in Tortoise is that, you know, if you believe the hypothesis or the fact that, you know, Brexit was a surprise in the UK in 2016 in the same way that Trump was a surprise in America, right? Because our newsrooms were operating in their own echo chambers and weren't necessarily in the communities that we seek to serve, because that's what we do. We are a public service in so many ways. We seek to serve the societies that we live in and operate in those communities. But we had it, but there's a disconnect, and it was happening on both sides of the Atlantic. So in our very small way, and we are tiny, we are just starting out, but in our very small way, the idea of Tortoise being open and slow means that in the openness of what we do, the idea of the thinking being the beginning of our editorial process, so creating this organised system of listening where everyone has a seat at the table, that we listen before we report out, and we don't do breaking news, we're trying to talk about what's driving the news. Those feel, in our way, a small way of being able to be more tapped, you know, listening first, being more tapped into some of those things, means that we'll hopefully not miss some of those stories that are really sort of there in plain sight, but where our newsroom can connect into those communities. So that's how we do it. And to make sure we're not, because we're obviously a membership and we're paid for, to make sure we're not our own liberal elite echo chamber, which is potential. Yeah. Every membership funds a membership in a community network. And so my team and I put as much energy into acquiring a paid for customer as we do in acquiring a community network member.
Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, so we have a one for one model. So we got.
And where do they come from, the community memberships? Where do you get them from?
So we go and find community partners. So I've just come off our Open News Tuesday thinking, which is every Tuesday. We don't have a set agenda for our thinking. It's literally turn up with the stories or turn up with what's on your mind and share it with us, and we'll share it with you. And we have a brilliant network partner called Jude, who runs a community organisation called Sound Delivery. And she makes it her purpose to give voice to, you know, groups of people who are trying to get their stories across. So she media trains them. She creates programmes for them. So she brings in lots of different voices from lots of different communities into our newsroom. So in the height of COVID, we did an Unheard Voices really early on. And she brought a huge number of Filipino domestic workers into our newsroom so we could hear firsthand what was happening inside lockdown houses. So you know, you have to go out of your way. I mean, it takes as much energy to build a subscription machine as does a community network machine. And we have as much energy in both. So we'll work with everyone from the Sutton Trust to the Social Mobility Foundation to, and the whole idea is, if you can't get the membership of Tortoise to look like the community or the population that we're in, we're sort of failing. So, you know, we'll look at our membership base and go, oh, we're underrepresented on people in Coventry. And then we'll go and find network partners in Coventry and we'll say, right, come on then. How can we make sure that Tortoise is as relevant for you as it would be for London? So that's how we do it. It's bloody hard work. Bloody hard work.
I was going to say, you're not making it easy for yourself, are you? Because just getting subscriptions is enough. You know, getting members is hard, and that's a lot of hard work. But I love what you're doing. And so, how is your membership model going? And back in 2019, you said that membership would fund the business, no adverts, right? So, how successful have you been in doing that? What are your membership numbers right now?
So we're over 50,000 paid for members. Our community is about 120,000, and that's people on trials and people who might just be on our newsletter. So that's sort of known membership community in its broadest sense. So we're doing okay, but it's a long old game membership. I mean, you know, I think it took the New York Times. When you look at how long does it take people to get to 1 million members, you know, the FT just did it, you know, like last year or something. And, you know, they've been going 20 odd years. The New York Times took 9 years. I mean, it's not a fast business. It's definitely for the tortoises in this world. But so it takes a long time. We're doing well. I think we're doing better than some people thought we would do.
Yeah.
And not as well as I would like us to be doing, but that's just me. I always like us to be doing better than we're doing. And in terms of the sort of path to independence, sustainability, profitability on that sort of, piece, we don't carry ads and we're not going to carry ads in our membership base, but we are now carrying ads in our off-platform audio.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that's sort of the free big reach.
Sure.
And so we do have advertising there. I don't sell it and I haven't got an ad team, but we do monetize it because it would be silly not to. We do and always have worked with partners. So people who like what we do. So in our first year, we worked with about 15 partners. This year to date, we've worked with 55 partners where they come and they love what we do. They love sense making, they love think-ins, and they love our audio storytelling. But the main thing that brands and businesses partner with us on is the think-in model.
Okay.
So they love think-ins, right? And so the whether it's privately for round tables or whether it's publicly on our summits and our coalitions around accelerating net zero or increasingly for their own people, so their employees. So we take the thinking model and we run it as a sort of employee voice proposition. So we help organisations listen to their employees in a kind of open, democratic way rather than the old-fashioned town hall mechanic. So that's a huge part of what we do. But the reality of it is that we're building a business where our independence will be guaranteed by the membership base.
Yeah.
So it will take us, you know, a few more years. I don't know how many. If it goes really well, you know, we'll be totally independent within 2-3 years from membership alone. If it takes a bit longer and a bit more tortoisey, it might take us 5. But ultimately, the path to sustainable independence is driven by your membership base. And then everything else around you can fuel growth. That's the model that we
have. How many staff have you got now?
So we are staff-wise around 50, but the whole team's around 60 because we've got some freelancers.
Big
so
stuff,
we're not tiny, but that's across all types of teams: the journalist team, membership, partners, design, you know, and all parts of the business.
And in terms of subscriber growth, how do you achieve that? You know, what's the onboarding process? How do you help with retention?
So So we haven't spent any money really on marketing yet. So we're still in that early, I think you call it sort of, I think most businesses would say MVP, minimum viable product. But, you know, obviously we're journalists, we never refer to us as an MVP. So so we're really early doors still, because we've only been public for 2 years in April. So we're just over 2 years old. And the great thing is that over 55% of all of our members have come through a referral. So basically, it is operating as a membership model. So you join Charlotte and you'll recommend us to a friend, and then you'll recommend, you know. And so most of our growth has been organic and also referral based. So good old fashioned word of mouth.
Yeah.
The other areas where we've seen acquisition come from is then the audio storytelling, or the sort of storytelling that you've come across through shared articles in social or off platform. And then that's a basically creates a sort of, if you like, a targeting group that people come in off. So, which the good news is, it's your members and your stories, which is what you want.
But why is it lack of budget that you're not kind of doing a marketing push? Is that, or does it not fit with your business model? Why are you not sort of more heavily marketing?
It's quite expensive.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the headline is that we are going to do a raise at the back end of this year. So we will raise more money, and marketing will be one of the sort of reasons that you would invest in Tortoise, because you believe that actually by marketing it will grow faster. So, but when we set it up, we said we were going to raise money for the first 3 years to prove the model. We didn't plan for a pandemic. But I think that just made the model better, actually. It made us make some quite interesting choices around the thinking delivery and also the story focus in audio. But yeah, if I had more money, I'd do some marketing. You'll start to see us do more things. Yes. But equally, the great thing about being a journalism business is that your stories are such great assets, and actually they're a really good way. I think what's interesting about Tortoise is that we've got the double benefit of having great stories, and great stories always travel, but you've got a really engaged, passionate member base with an off the chart MPS score. Like, you know, I've never seen MPS scores like this, you know? And so that is our marketing today.
Yeah.
Tomorrow I might be doing some jazz hands.
and obviously you come from print background. Does print play a role in Tortoise's future?
Yeah, so we do a quarterly. We do a lovely little book once a quarter, which is a beautiful piece of print. We don't do it for all of our members. We do it for some of the kind of premium newsroom members. So actually, one of the things we did during COVID is because we were delivering everything digitally, we moved our pricing model to be much more in line with the sort of digital subscription ecosystem. So we went from being a sort of £250 a year membership to being sort of £100 a year, and sort of immediately changed all our pricing, stopped doing the book for new people, but just delivered it to our existing members. So we love print. But it will be for a small group of our membership. So sort of those that pay for it, and we sell it as a separate thing. But it's not the core. Our core proposition is think-ins and audio stories. So print is a nice to have and a beautiful thing that we love and adore.
So do you kind of see print as a luxury item?
I would love to do print every day. But for us, it is, because we operate on a startup cost base.
Yeah.
You know, print is an expensive delivery mechanism. I mean, that sounds dreadful, because there's still nothing as good, in my opinion, as a newspaper to kind of physically see story hierarchy and balance and all those things. So I am like, we still haven't cracked it, by the way. So, I mean, I'm still a Times subscriber. I mean, you know, I grew up on the Times, and I'll always be a Times reader. And I get the print and digital, I have the full subscription. And because I live in the country, I don't get my newspaper until like 10:30, you know, by the time it gets delivered to the house. So I've already read the Times on my phone in the app every day.
Yeah.
And when I get the paper and I flick through the paper, I have no concept of that story hierarchy when I then go back to the app. And the stuff that seems important on the app, when I look at it in print, it's like this big, you know? And I still think that the digital delivery of traditional printed news is not as good as the printed version.
So you're saying you like the hierarchy? You like, the hierarchy. But does it not mean you might miss something because your influence is a bias? Because of the hierarchy, you're being led by what the editor wants you to read. You might find something.
But you know? But then just read the BBC. I want to know what the editor of the Times thinks.
Okay.
I want people who spend all day thinking about these issues to give me a sense of perspective around the issues.
Yeah.
And so I can see both sides of the argument. But my but actually, I like that. I mean, I'm an over 45 year old reader, so I am definitely grew up with the construct and the concept of somebody who knows what they're doing, giving me a sense of, you know, giving guiding me around this stuff. So I think they're just very different, and I'm really struck by my own reaction to news as a result of reading the same journalism in print to as in the app.
So do you think there's always going to be, obviously, you know, the Times, whatever, well, I say obviously, isn't going to go anywhere, but do you think, do you see the likes of Tortoise and Slow News as a totally complementary product to standard news coverage?
Yes, I do.
Or do you see it replacing it?
No, it's complementary. It's different.
So do you think people will always have subscription with you and subscription elsewhere?
Yes, I think they would. And the reason I think that, well, I think the UK is a very difficult market, right? Because we have the BBC, and the BBC is like a brilliant, you know, we should be all very proud of it. But it does mean that some of the commercial challenges around reimagining news for this age are more stark in the UK than they are in other markets. So if you just look at, say, the Reuters journalism report, you can see that only 7% of people in the UK pay for news. Right, or have a propensity to pay for news. It's like in the in the mid 20s in the US now, and it's in the high 40s in Scandinavia. Yeah. If you then look at, and so I think that is a challenge for us. And then if you look at the data underneath that, which says the propensity to have two or more subscriptions, that is super high in the US and Scandinavia, super low in the UK, right? So I think the UK is a really tough market. As we think through these challenges, I think it's really, I think we have a very uniquely tough market in that sense. Mm-hmm. But in its broader sense, I think Tortoise is a complement to a Times or a New York Times or one of these other more comprehensive, covering all the bases news sources, right? And interestingly, I would say this, wouldn't I? Interestingly, when we first set out, I was like, well, it's obvious, isn't it? We're just the complement to the Times and the Telegraph or the Guardian or the Mail. I'm going to go around and seal the newspapers and ask them if they want to do some sort of joint initiatives together.
Yeah.
I grew up in that industry. I should know that we hate each other and we fight each other before we would even fight people outside. And they're all like, why would we work with you? You're in a competition. I'm like, no, guys. You're in competition with Facebook. You're in competition with all this stuff that's outside of the industry.
Yeah.
You guys, get together. Have some fun. Protect the industry. Yeah. Stop seeing me as your enemy. Yeah. I'm not. I'm your partner in crime. And so it was amazing. I sort of naively popped along to the Telegraph and said, come on, how about we bundle up? And what was interesting is that the marketeers were like, yeah, that's kind of interesting because you've got a young audience, we've got an older audience.
Yeah,
you're doing this, we're doing this. Oh, we can see it. It got killed by the managing or by the deputy editor or the managing editor.
So is legacy media, often that is a problem, do you not think? Stuck in their ways. Do you think that has got to change and will it change?
So I think I always say, You have to stay where you are today and look back to see how far you've come in our industry, right? When you're in it, it feels like the change is like you're in treacle, the change is really slow, you need moments like COVID to come along or the dot-com crash or like massive existential external things that happen to you in order for you to all go, oh, shit, we better wake up and do something about this. And that really upsets me. I also just think, if I'm honest, as an industry, the talent skews towards the journalists and not towards the business people because it isn't a glamorous industry anymore. You know, like when I left university, you know, actually it was sort of an okay commercial job, you know, advertising, creative industry, sort of okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But it wasn't like the top notch. I mean, I fell into it, right? It wasn't sort of, oh, I want to go and work in the commercial side of a news brand. And so I think, if I'm honest, the challenge is that you need to have proper partnerships between the editorial team and the commercial team. I mean, I think David Pemsel and Kath Viner at The Guardian are perfect examples of where that really worked. Like, it really did work. They did a brilliant job together on The Guardian, right? And The Guardian hasn't followed the path of you must do this or you must. It's ploughing The Guardian path through. And I think that actually that dynamic where you've got real respect at the kind of commercial side and the editorial side, I think is what's missing, in my opinion.
Is that what makes you good at what you do? Because are you good at working with journalists?
I love them. They're difficult bastards.
And you get okay.
But I love them.
But you understand them and you respect their what they're trying to achieve. And is that what makes it work?
So I think there is a, well, I mean, you'd have to ask the editors I've worked with. I've worked with a lot of them. I'm sure you could find some that would agree with that statement and some that would disagree with that statement. But I'd like to think overall they'd say I'm quite a good partner in crime to work with. And I think it starts from really basic things, which is you have to, like in the industry, you have to know the product and love the product in order to kind of influence it. And I think sometimes, you know, people sort of think, you know, like if you're a marketeer, you go, well, I don't have to wear nappies in order to market nappies. Well, yeah, that's true. But you do have to read the bloody product, give a shit about the product and live and breathe it to be able to kind of be able to influence and have that argument. So I think there has been a sort of arrogance on both sides, a different type of arrogance. And culturally, I do think that the dynamic works when you have real partnership between the journalists and the commercial leaders. And I think that for many, many years, it wasn't a partnership because you had the pages of a paper and then you had a 25x4 and never the twain shall meet. And so these guys did their thing. These guys did their thing.
They were
united in we want more circulation, we want more eyeballs, we want more audience. But they never had to really have difficult conversations. And the success of and the future of the industry I love is all about having difficult conversations, and therefore that requires a very different, more collaborative, more culturally nuanced way of thinking. And the editor is used to being omnipotent. I mean, I spent 20 years in a newsroom with nameless, one of the newsrooms I worked in, where people would refer to the editor as the editor and would say, oh, you've met the editor. And I'd say, yeah, I've met Bob, let's call him.
Yeah.
And they'd be like, oh, you call him Bob. And I'm like, of course I call him Bob. For God's sake, he's just a man, right? He's not the editor. What is the editor? And these people would say, I've never met him.
Wow.
And I'd be like, oh, my God, how can that? So I think, and it's changed. It's changing a lot. And it's changed a lot.
It is changing.
Yeah, it is changing. But I do think they're not, look, I don't think the tradition, I think we have to believe that a great portion of the brands that we grew up with and love will find a path through. I think the challenge, if I'm honest, is the vacuum of local media, what happens there. And I do think we need a solution in local for replacement of local news. And I don't think you can just leave that to the BBC. I think we do need a healthy commercial dynamic there. I see some interesting things happening, but I haven't, there's no silver bullet that's like an obvious answer. And then I do worry about the populars, as I call it. But then by virtue of the fact you're called popular, you know, you're only popular for a time. Punch was the biggest selling news brand, you know, and died in the 20th century. So maybe the new popular hasn't yet been formed. But I do worry about some of these new startups where I see them making the mistakes of the digital ecosystem where they're over-reliant on one revenue stream. So the BuzzFeed's totally over-reliant on advertising. And I do think, I don't know if you can name a startup in news that's a mass popular startup that you think, oh, they're really, I mean, the HuffPo sort of, you know, BuzzFeed. I can't name I can't name one yet. It's been really hard for the last 25 years if you've worked in publishing. Really bloody hard.
Yeah.
Relentless. You're asked to do more with less resources. Everybody's, you know, everybody feels exhausted. It's relentless. Mm. But the news has always been relentless. It's a relentless industry. And sometimes you have to just take a moment to sort of say, you know, we're really lucky to be able to do what we do. And it's such a privilege. So, you know, I look at it and just think, if in some small way Tortoise creates one sustainable business model and way of operating, and Zetland over here and the Times find their path through, and, you know, the Mail with Mail Plus, and the Sun finds, you know, I really want the Sun to find its shine again. You know, I really want the Sun to be a success, because it matters to me. It matters to me that today less people read quality journalism than they did 25 years ago. Even though you can read a lot of it for free, there is less engagement in the journalism that's produced by a bunch of professionals, regardless of what brand they're working on.
We are coming to the close now. I just want to ask you, it's a couple more things really I wanted to ask about you, and you're obviously so key to the success of Tortoise. And, you know, James is obviously very clever, it's very smart to bring you on board because you have a huge experience. Now, you've described yourself as, in your 30s, you describe yourself as a bit Marmite. And now, anyone listening to this doesn't know Marmite. Basically, it's a love or hate relationship that the British public have with that sticky black stuff you put on your toast, which I love, I have to say. And you wish you would be more likeable. And I find that really interesting because you've had an amazing career, incredible career. Why does it matter? It made me think, is that a female thing? How many men in the media care whether they're liked or not?
So actually, it's not that I wanted to be more likeable. It's that I probably wanted those people that hated Marmite not to feel such an allergic reaction. So I think the thing that I learned is that in order to make the changes that we need to make in our industry, you have to bring people along with you. And so it's not likability as a person. I could not give a shit whether you like me or not. I actually care.
I'm so glad.
Yeah, no, I really don't give a shit. And anyone who knows me will tell you that's absolutely true. But I do think in order to make the changes and to bring people along, you can't be Marmite. And that was the thing, which is my own personal...
Okay. Yes.
Take it or leave it, like me or loathe me.
Yes.
You know, that's fine for a personal thing, but if you're trying to influence quite a lot of disparate stakeholders, she says that's a polite way of describing the sort of cacophony of opinions and voices that you will find in a newsroom and in a news business, you can't be Marmite. You have to be a Twiglet, which is you have to be that thing that Twiglets, for everybody who doesn't know what a Twiglet is a type of crisp that's covered in Marmite, but because it's not very thick Marmite, it's sort of bearable even if you hate Marmite. So you know, so I think my lesson to myself is you have to be able to, in order to change the outcomes for the industry we're in, you have to be able to influence a lot of different people.
Yeah.
And therefore you have to be able to walk in their shoes and find a way of bringing them on that journey that they feel comfortable with. And for some people, that's a move away from. And for other people, that's a move towards. Here's a big, hairy goal. Isn't this exciting? Or don't worry, it's not that scary because this will happen or this will happen. And so my sort of Marmite-ness of my 20s, which was fuck you all, you know, wasn't very helpful.
Yes. And I guess that comes, it's quite good. You've got to have a bit of fuck you about you when you're in your 20s and 30s, haven't you? And then you... Maybe
mature.
A bit more reasonable.
We mature.
Mature, yes. And so, you know, your incredible career, how would you like to be remembered? What were you most proud of achieving? And what would you like to be remembered for bringing to this industry that you are so passionate about?
Fighting the good fight. So I think I'd like to be remembered as someone who fought the good fight. Not always, not won every battle, but overall we get to a place where I've been part of, the, you know, a really important time in our industry in kind of making sure that we set ourselves up for the next 250 years. So I'd like people to sort of see me as part of that you know, I'm most proud of the fact that it's a really tough industry, and the people that you get to work with, you know, actually we're a really passionate bunch. You don't do this as an easy option job. And so you get to work with amazing people who really care. Yeah. So I'd like people to be able to sort of say she was one of the people that cared. She was one of the people that made a difference.
Well, that's it for episode 2 of Media Unscripted, presented by FIP. We really hope you enjoyed our conversation with Katie, and a big thank you to her for being so open and honest about the industry she is so passionate about. In our next episode, we'll be talking with the BBC about their 50-50 project, which the organisation has described as the biggest collective action on increasing women's representation in BBC content that there has ever been. The project has recently been expanded to include ethnicity and disability, and it hopes to inspire other media organisations to follow their example. Joining us are Lara Jonides, Creative Diversity Lead, and Miranda Holt, External Partners Lead, who talk frankly about why the media industry needs this initiative and what work is still to be done. This podcast wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, Pressreader, so a big thank you to them. And it also wouldn't be possible without you, our listeners. So please don't forget to like and subscribe. That's it for now, and we'll see you next time on Media Unscripted.